Hello, and this is Mike Harbath with another Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Rocket World Headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. As you know, Revenue Rocket is the world's premier growth strategy and M&A advisor for IT services companies. Today, I have my partners, Ryan Barnett and Matt Lockhart, with me, and we are going to talk about forecasting and how forecasting impacts your valuation pursuant to a transaction, and kind of do's and don'ts of forecasting and the way you should think about building your forecast. With that, I'll turn it over to Ryan and Matt.
Hey, good morning, Mike. Thanks for having us here today. Really interesting topic as we run into it daily. So when we look at valuating a company, we typically look at either your historical value in what you've done in the past. We pair that up with your discounted cash flow analysis of your future. And sometimes those two don't necessarily align. So today I want to pick Mike and Matt's brain on some of those things that we're seeing and understanding that forecasting can have a significant impact on the valuation if done correctly, and you can get buyers to believe it. So I'd love to kick it over let's say, Matt over here. Have you seen any examples of a forecasting that's gone either right or wrong lately?
Yeah. Well, I think that we've seen a bit of both, right? And I think that, you know, we guide our clients, you know, first and foremost, to have a forecast that's based in reality, right? The more that you can, you know, demonstrate the historical realization of past forecasts, right? The more that you can point to your pipeline and health and cleanliness of a sales pipeline to back up a forecast, all of these things are really good. And we've seen a number of those scenarios here recently. You know, Ryan, you and I were just on a call, you know, with a new client of ours on a sell side mandate. And, you know, they are just by the book and by the numbers. And in their case, they have always forecasted conservatively. And so there's an opportunity, you know, for them to kind of go, okay, well, you've forecasted conservatively and you've always beat those forecasts. So let's, you know, sort of up that number. And then conversely, Mike, I know you've got a ton of stories where, you know, we've had to guide our clients to be a little bit more realistic with their forecast because, you know, everybody likes to shoot for the moon, but, you know, again, reality is important.
Yep. Thanks, Matt. I tell you, you know, a wish is not a plan. Okay. And I think a lot of people, when they start to think about their forecast, maybe it's the first time someone's asked them for a material forecast in their business. We say that often with sellers and they struggle a little bit like, hey, how do we forecast this? You know, I think, you know, the reality of the matter is you've got to have a credible story behind the forecast. You can't have had flat or flagging growth or, you know, growing in single digits year over year and then expect you're going to grow at 30 or 40% a year for the next 5 years. It's not a credible argument. So you have to give some thought about, you know, what is going to happen. And this is a non-synergistic forecast, meaning if you're contemplating a sale or you're a buyer looking at a company, the forecast should not include buyer synergies. A forecast should assume that you're going to move forward as a standalone business and you have a strong business case to be made for achieving that forecast. And to your point, Matt, about pipeline and, you know, having credible pipeline and having an approach that will achieve that pipeline, you know, is important. Now, you know, there's certainly sellers that have are preparing to sell and maybe they've remodeled their sales organization or changed marketing and sales and they're beginning to see traction and they can argue that, you know, they just don't have a lot of historical data to justify the forecast, but at least can make a plausible argument that the changes have already been made in the business in order to achieve sort of a new growth outcome. But if those changes haven't been made, it's pretty hard to argue that there's going to be a material change in the growth trajectory versus, you know, what's occurred over the last 4 or 5 years. Certainly you can explain away some anomalies in the history and that, you know, hopefully you won't have those anomalies moving forward, but you have to put forth a credible forecast. And many, many times I'd say, oh, I don't know, you know, maybe 25% of the time we see these wish sort of not a planned forecast that have no real methodology other than we'd like it to be this. And they put that forth as their strategy or their methodology to grow.
Yeah, yeah, I, you know what we.
Well, I was just going to jump in, Ryan. I think that, you know, one of the things for, you know, for everybody to keep in mind is that history really is the greatest predictor of future success, right? And so anybody is going to be looking at historical trends in conjunction with what people are, you know, claiming for a forecast, and really rightly so. So in those cases where an organization really doesn't have a lot of experience in developing a defensible, you know, forecast, you know, that's going to be an area that, that anyone is going to go to is just what do the historical trends look like. And to Mike's point, you know, you can tell a story. But that story needs to be based in reality in terms of operational changes and or new leadership and or, again, a defensible pipeline. So sorry to cut you off, Ryan.
No, you're totally good. It actually leads right into my question. In 2020, Mike, we made a very concerted change in something how we asked for forecasts. Instead, we asked for opinions. I'm just curious, you know, why did we change that wording? Can you explain to the audience of why we asked for opinions compared to forecasts?
Well, I think the concept of a forecast kind of freaks out a business owner, particularly in the context of a pending M&A transaction. You know, oftentimes they start thinking about, well, if I make this forecast and there's a variable component to my in negotiation and my deal, call it an earnout or a gain share, you know, will a buyer hold me accountable to my forecast? And, you know, do I have if I understate it, you know, will we get a deal done at an optimum value? If I overstate it, will I be able to achieve that? You know, so there's a lot of things that, you know, people start to think about. I think when we ask about an opinion of where they're going to go with the business, that's easier, just mentally easier to think about, hey, you know, what's your opinion? This is an educated guess. You're the closest person to the business. What do you think the business will do if you were to continue to operate it and run it as you have been running it over the next 5 years as a forecast? And certainly the farther you get out, the more uncertainty there is in that forecast. And, you know, we do know one thing about all forecasts, and I think you have to keep that in mind, is that anytime we try to predict the future, the likelihood that you'll get it 100% accurate is very low or slim to none. It is an educated guess. And so when we think about an opinion versus a quote unquote forecast, you know, it makes it a little easier to get your head around that, formed sort of opinion. And I think it makes it also easier to provide it because it is simply educated guess in the end of what the business will do. We hope it's really informed and very educated, and you can parlay that to a potential buyer. It's super important to be able to do that. I think the other thing to understand, I'm going to just pivot here a little bit, to, you know, why are buyers asking for forecasts? Why do we need a forecast or an opinion? And what's rooted in that is when the buyer will see their return on investment or internal rate of return thresholds be met in their deal. It helps formulate their opinion of value based on when they're going to get a return. And that's why it has to have credibility when they look at it. If it doesn't, your value actually goes down and will dramatically be discounted, and oftentimes can mean the difference between getting a deal negotiated or not if your forecast just doesn't hang together well with the historical performance of the business. So the primary reason for a buyer to ask for a forecast or an opinion of how you will grow has to do with how they can look for synergies, how they can plan for return rates, and how they justify the purchase price. And so understand that. It's not simply an exercise of getting a valuation done and that's it. It has much more impact and reach into how buyers consider acquisitions and why they would consider an acquisition for growth, and ultimately how they justify purchase price. So back to you, Ryan.
Yeah, I would like to note that it's one interesting part about the opinions and forecasts is that if you have had remarkable changes in the business, let's say a new service line that you've created, or perhaps a sales function that you've matured. For example, if you've only ran with two salespeople in the past, you've got six now, you can have a forecast that does dramatically change. I think the big portion that you've uniquely identified here is that if you have major upward shifts in revenue compared to your historical performance, that risk is going to be accounted for and the valuation will likely be, it will most certainly be discounted because of that. So it's an interesting balance between you want to show a great picture of where you're going and how you're going to get there. And if you can back it up with this product, this service, this solution, this sales team, this methodology, those forecasts can be good for future valuations. So I'm going to ask a kind of specific question here. When do you think, and this comes into kind of, I think your answer is going to come a little bit of deal structures, but when should EBITDA actually be looked at? Should EBITDA be looked at as a point in time of what it is right now? And keep in mind that the deals that we're seeing today are typically a multiple of EBITDA. Should we look at now? Should it be looked at the last trailing 12 months? Should it be looked at annualized? For example, if I'm in July, and do I take just times two? Or do I look for future EBITDA? And how does that pair up with how companies and buyers should be looking at EBITDA?
Well, I have a lot of opinions on this one. If you were to have asked me this question before, COVID-19 and the pandemic, I would say the majority of the way buyers were looking at it was on a trailing 12 months EBITDA. They would tend to look at it because the earnings consistency in the businesses and the growth was pretty easy to predict, right? COVID sort of thrown a monkey wrench in that plan a little bit. And I think, frankly, rightly so. And it's more and more buyers looking at annualized EBITDA for the most recent month. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One, because you may have some anomalies in the trailing 12 months EBITDA due to COVID, although those are starting to age out now as we're in, August of 2021. Much of the pressure on EBITDA for IT services companies due to pandemic was in Q2 of 2020. So some of that's aged out in the trailing 12 month view, but some of it not. Some, people still had challenges in Q3 and, many of them recovered in Q4. So there's much of their P&L, depending on the individual company, that was kind of screwed up in 2020 due to the pandemic. And so we've seen a trend since then to look at it much more around the annualized EBITDA. And I think that probably for the most recent period, and I'd say that's probably a more accurate reflection of where the business is going, particularly in a services business, if it's managed well and is consistent. And so, that will tend to, in a growing company, benefit the seller maybe a little bit versus a trailing 12-month EBITDA. But with that said, there's always a difference of opinion in justifying EBITDA from what we would call buyer's EBITDA or seller's EBITDA. Sellers want to optimize EBITDA, maximize add backs, you know, make it as high as possible. Likewise, buyers want to try to, you know, beat that down, and they have an idea of what buyer's EBITDA is. And generally, if there's a big chasm between those two, you know, that can be tough to bridge. And so, you know, it's part of what we do as an M&A advisor here at Revenue Rocket. We advise companies on kind of how to optimize EBITDA, but do it in a way, if you're a seller, to have it be plausible and easy for a buyer to understand and support. And likewise, you know, we help bring the ends to the middle. You know, that's what a credible M&A advisor does. They help bridge the gap between buyer's EBITDA to seller's EBITDA, which exists in every deal. So hopefully that answers the question, Ryan.
Yeah, I'll jump in, Mike. You know, I think to sort of bring that home to reality in the last year is you know, looking at a couple of different expenses, right? One would be, you know, brick and mortar office expense, where a lot of firms are now, especially in the IT services industry, are recognizing that they have been just as productive and their customers were just as well served by having people working remotely. And, you know, so from a forecasted EBITDA perspective, you know, firms may have plans to be subleasing office space, to be decreasing office space and the like. And that may not have been reflected in the trailing 12 EBITDA. And so there's one, you know, example where looking at it on an annualized and or even forecasted basis would be, you know, wholly applicable. Another would be, you know, travel expenses, you know, which oftentimes, especially for the larger, you know, national firms is a massive expense. And we know that there is going to be a decreased amount of travel moving forward overall, right? Because we've all been able to get by and serve our customers, you know, very well without, you know, the full sort of travel burden being in place. And so I just bring those two up as real life examples that we've seen just, you know, driven, you know, from the pandemic that is a reality that has an impact on valuation and forecasting, you know, that ongoing EBITDA.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, Matt. I'll just add a couple, flavor that a little bit. I mean, we've had, you know, real world examples where we've had a client, you know, save upwards of $400,000 a year on rent just by right-sizing their office. You know, that's a meaningful contribution to profit, and one in which, you know, changes the landscape of the business and the profitability of the business and frankly, the value of the business pretty markedly. And it's another reason why, you know, run rate EBITDA, is an important consideration, when looking at multiples. Ryan?
I just want to highlight here, though, that it's really hard to, on a buyer's, for example, we saw a P&L this week that had, they were anticipating 30% growth, or pardon me, 45% growth, but their EBITDA was going to go to 30% EBITDA margins going forward because of cost-cutting structures. There's a certain point in which there's a believability and a discount factor that really goes into this. If you, especially if you're trying to cut out expenses to get to a new business, your business has a certain line of expenses now. Cut up other things to cut yourself to profitability is tough.
Yeah, I think the, you know, one of the things that we've seen recently is just that, Ryan, where a leader, and this is a, you know, founder-led business, he's lost some key personnel. and key personnel in sales leadership, key personnel in you know, one of the lines of business. And, you know, obviously that had an immediate impact, you know, to the net margin of the business. Well, but is it sustainable, right? Those key personnel and having people in those roles is incredibly important. And so you can't point to a quick jump in net margin and then corresponding EBITDA and without being able to explain away the sustainability of running and growing the operation. So just, you know, real life example that we've seen quite recently.
Absolutely. Mike, I want to turn this over to you. Okay, let's say that we do find we see a very profitable future and a forecast that is a bit different than what we've seen in the past, but they can back it up. What happens to the terms of a deal if you have a really aggressive forecast? What should sellers expect if their valuation is based on a forecast heavy methodology?
Well, you know, certainly a buoyed forecast that's supported will have a positive impact on the valuation. However, it would mean that a buyer most likely would, and I think a seller, if they believe in their forecast, would want to have more of a variable gain share structure, earnout type structure. Now, it's important to note that earnouts are actually paid out most of the time. The statistics are, you know, 86% or more of the time earnouts are paid out at or above their index value. Provided, and I'll add this big caveat, provided they are structured properly. We make sure that with our clients that they're structured properly, and I can't really think of an earnout in recent times or maybe even ever that we've helped work on that did not get paid out at least the index value or what was expected. Because when they're structured properly, it's easy to do. Where earnouts run off the rails is when they're not structured properly or they're kind of messed up from a structuring perspective and they're too hard to actually pay out or calculate the value to pay out is where they oftentimes get screwed up. So as a seller who's got a fairly aggressive forecast that can be supported, you know, the litmus test that a buyer oftentimes will apply is, well, if you believe in that forecast, that's great. I'll pay you for it. But I'm going to pay you for it based on you achieving those objectives in a gain share. And I think as a seller, you have to be practical about the fact that, you know, you have 100% of the risk today of achieving that forecast if you don't sell the business. If you sell the business, you lower your risk, but you can still participate in that upside. So I think it is also a litmus test for the buyer to see, do you really believe in the forecast? Are you willing to take that variable or earnout? If you are, then yeah, maybe we'll do the deal at that level. If you're not, we really got to revisit the forecast.
That's great. I think this really, you know, you really start to see this when you see business combinations in which stock or equity is given in the company. So if you're looking for future performance, but understand that there could be massive gains within secondary markets. We have clients that have taken companies public, for example, on stock exchanges. That forecast starts to lead into equity, and in the case of this client, the most of the time that they're, or I think all of the time, they're seeing exceeding gains, and those forecasts are being put to work in long-term plans that are using stock and equity.
Yeah, and rolling equity is a good test, right? If you believe in your forecast and you're going to be able to do more together than apart, then it's in the seller's interest if they're going to continue to be working in that business, in particular, to roll equity, as they call it, convert equity, and make sure that they can take advantage of that upside.
Great. Well, that was the last question that I really had today. Mike or Matt, any last parting thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, you know, I a reminder, you know, for anyone listening is that we've been in your shoes before. We're all former operators, you know, we've done this. And so, yeah, I think having a discussion around forecast with an advisor, hopefully an advisor who's, you know, been in your shoes is worth its weight in gold. Regardless of where you're at in the process, if you're on the market today, if you're considering being on the market, if you're considering an acquisition, you know, just having a discussion with an advisor who's got the experience can shape your understanding of what people are looking for and just really increase your chances of success. So, you know, let's talk.
Thanks, Matt. And with that, I think we'll tie a ribbon on it for today. Thanks to all of you that are listening. If you guys have any questions of us or requests, as you think about your forecast, feel free to drop us a note at info@revenuerocket.com, and we'll certainly get right back to you. We hope that you tune in next week.